Hey, everybody. Welcome to Defy. This is a podcast about stories, because everyone has a story to tell. We're all about sharing stories of women and non-binary individuals and how they have defined the odds, persevered through incredible circumstances, and transformed their lives. Is this a show about perfection? No, because it doesn't exist. Is this a show full of empty self-help quotes for you to put on your Instagram? No, that is not our style. This is a show about breaking the rules, creating your own path, and being your true self. Because remember, well-behaved women rarely make history. Non-binary folks excel at breaking models. So come on, let's get out there and defy. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Defy. This is episode 16. I can't believe that we've created 16 episodes, but the reason that I know that we have is because I am tired of talking. I feel like all I do is talk. But I've been so thrilled with the support that we've received for this podcast. And I also just wanted to remind people, just in case you didn't realize, yes, we have this podcast, Defy Community, but we have like a real community. And Adrian Bradley, who is my guest today. Hello, Adrian.
Hello, hello.
Hello, is also part of the Defy Community. You are a Defy member. So do you mind just giving like a 15-second pitch on why people might want to consider checking out Defy?
Yeah, so if you are looking for a community of women, a community of non-binary individuals that are just all about empowering, connecting, and providing the support needed in business and work and your personal life, Defy is where it's at. From the yoga classes early mornings to the lounges in the evening, they have something for any and everyone. And Defy has also supplemented so many things and made so many more great connections that I wouldn't have had in the past. Attending one meeting is, you just feel so jazzed after, no matter what it is. So I really encourage everyone, if you are looking for a community of just badass individuals that are just there to support you on every level, Defy is where it's at.
I did not pay Adrian to say this. I am so, well, honestly, I just love to have the feedback because, you know, we've been working so hard to create this meaningful community based on, you know, the best of behavioral science. And you've been like a day one with us. And so we really appreciate you. And so if anyone's interested in checking out more about Defy, all you have to do is type in www.defy.community. We also always throw in our website on the show notes. So feel free to check it out. But now let's talk about what we're really here to talk about. And today we're talking about, we're not sanitizing death today. So this entire episode is going to be, you know, Adrian's story with loss, the loss of her father. And when we were prepping for this, we were like, but we are not here to be like, we're telling you how it really is and how like it really feels to lose someone, how it really feels to watch someone, you know, go through, you know, incredible physical changes as their body starts to fail, and what it's like to navigate those, you know, intimate relationships when it doesn't go exactly as planned. So Adrian's like, I think I talked something about like not sanitizing death when we did our prep call, and you're like, yes, let's lead out with that. We are not sanitizing this shit. We are getting real. So Adrian, before we start, do you want to just kind of give a little introduction in terms of who you are, just to provide everyone with some context?
Yeah. So my name is Adrian Bradley. I am a BCBA in Detroit, Michigan. I have lived in Michigan my entire life. So looking to move here really soon, maybe to Arizona.
Where we would welcome you with open arms.
I've worked in the field of behavior analysis probably for the last 4 years, but recently really trying to work on myself as an individual. And I'm here to just share more about myself and open up a little bit more than I may have in the past. And I'm just so grateful that you make everyone feel so comfortable to do so, Sarah.
Well, thank you. I mean, this is emotional work, both obviously most importantly for the people that come on this podcast, but also for me and, you know, doing prep calls and really having an idea of what we want to talk about and where we want to have these stories go is an exercise of, you know, love. And really what we've been trying to do here is just tell stories of incredible people, because literally everyone does have a story to tell. And by doing this, you know, we normalize having hard conversations. We offer people the opportunity to understand they're not alone, because every podcast episode we've had, I've always received feedback of like, oh my gosh, I thought it was just me, or I'm so glad you talked about this. And, you know, also just understanding that we're at the end of the day, we're all just humans and we're trying to live our best lives. And sometimes we succeed at that and sometimes we don't. And it's kind of an ongoing journey. And that's what really kind of binds us together. I'd also like to give a shout out to Adrienne. She is the president of the Black Association for Behavior Analysts. So check out BABA. We can link the BABA website also to the show notes. And we are going to start in the year 2008. And where you are in Michigan, and specifically because you are in the Detroit area, anyone that is familiar, I was originally, my whole family's from the Midwest. I was born in Michigan, understands that the infrastructure of Michigan has been the auto industry for decades and decades. And what happened that was really significant in 2008 that really started, that changed your life and your family's life and the lives of thousands of other people within the auto industry?
Yeah. So in 2008, we saw the market crash. And what that did to families in Michigan, particularly the auto industry, went bankrupt. And so we all know when a company goes bankrupt, in order for them to save money, they need to cut salaries. But nothing of this magnitude had been seen since the original Great Depression across the board in 2008. So not just the Midwest, but particularly Michigan was hit because the automakers of Ford, Chrysler, and GM, we call them the big three here, they all are headquartered in Michigan. So majority of the people that work for those companies of engineers, office workers, admin, things like that work in Michigan. And then it is dispersed throughout our entire state economy. Our state economy is very heavily and still primarily the auto industry. So whether that is the parts that are being made for the cars and allowing those plants to run, or the paint that is used to paint the cars, or whether that is your engineers and your executive leadership teams, they all function out of Michigan. So I can dive right into the beginning of the story from there.
Yes.
My father worked for GM for 25 plus years. We all know our parents of the baby boomers, I think they were the baby boomers. Mm-hmm. they were loyal to a company and they stayed with that company until they retired. And millions of people in Michigan did that with the auto industry. So my dad graduated from the University of Michigan and boom, got an engineering job with GM and was GM engineer. 2008, they go bankrupt and my dad gets laid off. And that's when everything started to go downhill. I grew up in Troy, Michigan. And so the location matters because I will admit that Troy, Michigan is a very affluent city. And so I had lived there since I was in kindergarten. So I grew up with a lot of privilege. And growing up with privilege when you don't understand how the other half of people feel or live and what they have to do to get by in the day to day, you are a very privileged, naive brat. That's the way that I would describe me looking back. I was a very naive brat. And so with that, I did not understand economy. I didn't understand jobs. You know, we didn't have to know those things. And so my dad comes home one day and I'm like, why are you home? You're home early. And he says, you know, Adrian, I get laid off from my job today. He had to explain to me what being laid off meant. And so that meant that he no longer had a job. And so I said, oh, okay, well, go get another job. Not understanding how the economy works when you're in a recession and, you know, your major reliance and primary form of income goes bankrupt, and how that affects not only the auto industry, but any other industry, period. And so I didn't realize how not easy it would be for him to get a job.
And in fact, you were mad at him. Like, what's your problem? Like, why aren't you getting another work? You're like, you graduated from the University of Michigan. You are, you know, clearly a skilled electrical engineer, not recognizing that what was happening to your dad at GM was throughout the entire auto industry. So it's like, where do you pivot from there when your only work experience has been within the specific industry that's being decimated?
Correct. I was so upset with him. I felt like he wasn't doing enough for our family. I felt like he wasn't trying hard enough or anything like that. And I also later on felt like the job that he did end up getting, he wasn't doing enough for me as his child, as his daughter, and what my needs were at the time. So fast forward 2 years, I go to college. My dad ends up getting a tutoring position. I'm working for the local school district. And so that obviously is not the same amount of money as a electrical engineer working for GM for 25 years. So we started to go into having financial troubles. You know, my mom worked as a speech pathologist, still works as a speech pathologist for one of the local school districts. And she was making good money, but not good enough for one kid in college, one kid going to college, and a mortgage that was almost $2,000 a month. And on top of the other bills and things like that, going from two incomes to one income is always rough. And again, I still would describe myself as this naive, privileged brat, but I was being an adult. So I was a naive, privileged, bratty bitch. and going into that. So I get
and something, some important context. One thing that I do want to add is that we, just before you get to the college piece, or two things. One, your father was severely depressed by the loss of his job, which would make, of course, so much sense. And he was also sick, and that he didn't talk about it.
Yes. So my dad, when he got laid off, went into depression. But at that time, no one talked about mental health. No one talked about depression, anxiety. Shoot, no one talked about schizophrenia. You know, no one talked about those things back then. And he was a very traditional man. You know, he was a man's man. He was traditional. My parents had a traditional gender roles type of marriage. So my dad always paid the bills. My mom did all the things with the kids, would pick us up, you know, all of that. And then at the same time, he fell into a depression. My parents' marriage also fell into a stage of depression almost. And the number one thing that they say causes rift in marriages is financial troubles. And so I go to college, he's got this job. And at that point, because I felt like he wasn't doing enough, because I felt like he was woe is me, and, you know, he was sick, but our parents never really told us what was going on. I had no idea how severely sick he was, but I could tell because we would have family friends and I would go over to their house and they'd be like, oh, how's your dad? And I'm like, he's fine. you know, and they would be like, oh, how's his health? And I'm like, it's fine.
Yeah. Why are you asking?
Why are you asking me? I had no idea. So I go to college, and at this point, me and my dad's relationship is not good. We would argue all the time, and I felt like I was a young adult, and I had zero respect for him at all, because I felt like he wasn't doing enough, and I felt like he wasn't getting my needs met, but getting other students' needs met and things like that, and would go above and beyond for the students that he worked for, but would not go above and beyond for me as his daughter. My parents were still married at this time. Our relationship was horrible. We would get into arguments, and I would stand up to my dad. And I was the girl that would say, what are you going to do? Hit me? Hit me. Go ahead. Like, that's not going to do anything. And so, Sarah, you as a parent, if your daughter is like, yeah, bitch, what are you going to do? You would probably flip shit. Like, who do you think you're talking
to? I might flex. Yeah.
Yes. And so imagine that happening all the time. And again, my dad is a man's man, you know?
Yeah. And you are attacking him at the core of his own sense of identity.
Yes. At the core. And I am this young 20-year-old, 19, not giving a shit and just being like, well, what are you going to do? You're not going to do anything. Because ultimately, he never did do anything. So fast forward, I get through college. It is my the summer going into junior year.
Yeah.
And June, my dad has a scheduled hernia surgery. And so 2 weeks prior to this hernia surgery, which I think is a very important point to make, is we got into a really, really bad argument. And he kicks me out of the house. And so this is 2 weeks prior to the surgery. So my mom is like, hey, you need to take your dad to his surgery appointment. She was teaching summer school, because at this point she was always teaching summer school to keep up with the bills and things like that. And I was like, why? Like, we don't get along. Like, can I drop him off? But my dad was really, really apprehensive around doctors. He did not like the hospital. He just had really, really bad history, but then also just the medical trauma that the Black community goes through. It was very prevalent within my father. So he didn't want to be alone at the hospital. So my mom was like, no, you have to stay until I get off of work. So when you go to the hospital the day before a surgery, you got to get there early, can't eat, you know? So I had to take him at like 9 a.m. in the morning, but they weren't doing the surgery until the next day, but he needed to come into the hospital the previous day. And so I'm sitting in the hospital room. It's just me and my dad. This is one of the first times that I really am spending any type of time with him since he's kicked me out of the house 2 weeks prior. So imagine it's very, very awkward. And one of the questions that he asked me is, Adrian, I don't want to die with our relationship like this. And what can I do to fix our relationship? Me being the naive, privileged brat and, you know, whatever, I say, there's nothing you can do. Our relationship is what it is. It had been going on for 4 years at this point. So it is what it is. And very shortly after, my mom comes. And so I'm like, okay, bye, deuces. And that was the last thing that I said to my dad before I left. So fast forward 24 hours, I get a phone call from my mom, and she's like, you need to come to the hospital. And I'm like, why? I'm not coming. She's like, your dad isn't doing good. You need to come to the hospital. And I'm like, okay. Get to the hospital. My dad is in complete liver and kidney failure, is unconscious, and has internal bleeding going on. And I was like, what happened? He was going in for a hernia surgery.
Right. A routine, easy surgery.
Routine, easy. And I remember the doctor talking to him the previous day, but said nothing. You know, they had no concerns that anything was going to go wrong or anything. He didn't even get to the surgery. And so he ends up passing away 2 days after he goes unconscious.
And this is June 23rd, 2012.
This is June 23rd, 2012. And the last things that I said to my dad was, no, our relationship cannot be fixed. It is what it is. You're going to be fine. It's just a hernia surgery. Mm-hmm. That wrecked me. I cried initially because my mom was crying and I had never seen my mom that hysterical or anything like that. But after that, I didn't cry for months.
Yeah.
And I spoke at his funeral and I was like, why do I have to speak? We had this trash relationship, right? This horrible, toxic, unhealthy relationship, but you want me to speak. My mom didn't have the energy, which I understand. And my brother, I have an older brother, 3 years mm-hmm. older than me. He didn't have the energy either. And all the while, they hadn't seen me cry. They hadn't really seen me upset. I was in autopilot mode. I was in, okay, what do we got to do? What do we got to check off? We got to plan this funeral. Are we getting him cremated? No. Okay, let's go pick out a casket. You know, you're just in the mode of planning this funeral. Funeral happens. I don't cry or anything. Funeral ends. People are coming over. They give you the food and they're like, oh, what can we do? And I was like, I'm fine. Because I would think, you know, in the realm of our relationship over those last 4 years from 2008 to 2012, I would think, you know what, like my dad could die and I wouldn't give a shit. Mm-hmm. Like I don't ever have to talk to him. I don't ever have to see him again. Mm-hmm. And I would have those thoughts every time we would get into an argument. I'd be like, man, can you just go away? Yeah. I remember asking my mom, like, when are you going to divorce him? Because their relationship was also trash and all I was seeing was arguments. They weren't sleeping together. They weren't anything. Yeah. And me and my dad were getting into arguments. And so I was like, can we just go? Can we just leave? Not understanding relationships at that time and marriage and mental health and all of that. Because also understand my dad is depressed this entire time.
Yeah. Severely depressed. Yeah.
Severely depressed this entire time. So we get the medical records after, you know, somebody passes, you get the medical records. And in the medical records, the same year he got laid off, his doctor told him he needed to get a kidney transplant. He ended up having what they call sarcoidosis. And sarcoidosis affects either your liver, your lungs, or your kidney, but it rarely affects the kidneys. And it just so happened that with my dad, it affected the kidneys. And so he needed a kidney transplant 4 years prior, right? Just like a black man, he's like, oh, yeah, I'll get to it. Or is that necessary? You know, but also he was severely depressed. Mm-hmm. So he's depressed and being told you need to get this surgery to stay alive.
Right. Plus on top of the historical context of the treatment of a black man by the American, you know, medical industry. So he never saw it. I mean, he didn't seek any treatment or help.
He never did. He never did. Years. I think he was taking like his meds to maintain it, you know, but never took that step to actually improve his health.
Because technically he passed of septic shock, correct?
Yes. So technically he passed of septic shock because he had all of the internal bleeding that was happening. And because his kidney was not regulating the blood, you know, your blood goes through your kidneys and then it takes out all the bacteria.
Yeah.
And he had kidney and liver failure.
Failure.
So technically he died from sepsis. However, the hospital that we originally went to was not equipped to deal with what he was going through. We also went there on a weekend. So all of the primary doctors were out of the office because it's the weekend and they like to work Monday through Friday. So we had to wait until a Monday to see the primary doctor. And the minute primary doctor is like, oh yeah, we can't do this. We have to fly him to a downtown hospital. But they didn't think he was going to make the ambulance ride. And they were iffy on if he was going to make a helicopter ride. And he ends up making the helicopter ride. But I remember the nurse, and shout out to nurses. I know we've been talking about nurses during COVID, but man, nurses really go through some really psychological things in their work. It was the end of her shift. And I remember her screaming, like, if he was here a couple days ago, we could have saved him. Mm-hmm. And she had to end her shift on a death.
Yeah.
And that was really hard. I didn't tell you this, Sarah, but I did write her a thank you letter. Because I remember somebody telling me, you know, nurses get thank you letters and they read them quarterly when they have to go to, like, nurses kind of have to go to therapy, as part of their contract with work. So they,
I would only hope so, given the, what they have to deal with on a daily basis. Good grief.
Yeah. So they read these thank you letters at these meetings. So if anyone is out there that has lost somebody or knows a nurse that has lost somebody, write them a letter, especially during this pandemic. Yeah. Write them a letter because they will read it and they will appreciate it so much.
And so you get into your junior year in college and you are like, what can I do to numb myself? And I'm going to do
absolutely
all of the drugs and alcohol.
All the drugs, all the sex.
All the things.
All the things. But on the surface level, if you were to look at me, right, I was still going to class. I still got good grades. Yeah. I was still in the community. But at night, where's the weed? Where's the shrooms? Where's the acid? Like, where's this? Or who can give me attention? And I started falling into unhealthy relationships. Mm-hmm. I wanted to feel wanted. I did not feel wanted by my father. We talk about having daddy issues and how daddy issues show up in relationships and your friendships. And that's me. And during this pandemic, I've been forced to reflect on who I am and why I engage in things, and the ways that I am used to coping and getting through stressful times was stripped away from me because I can't be around people. Mm-hmm. I am a very outgoing person. I am a very, like, I want to be around my friends. I want to go and have a good time, and whatever we need to do to make that happen. But during the pandemic, that wasn't able to happen because being around people could literally get you killed. You know, you could die. So it forced me to really deal with my shit myself. And it all starts back for me in 2008 with my dad. But also the messiness, you know, we talk about not sanitizing death, right? We talk about when someone dies, you're like, oh, it'll get better over time, or, oh, here's some food, or what can I do?
He's in a better place, so you should just be peaceful. Yeah.
Yeah. No, fuck that. Like, death is not easy. Grief is not easy. And relationships are not black and white. Mm-hmm. It's okay that I had this treacherous relationship and then I had to deal with this very unexpected, kind of treacherous death at the same time. And it wasn't black and white. You know, I didn't cry at the funeral for months. I didn't miss my dad. I was so used to not talking to him for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. Mm-hmm. So it took me months to really, like, break down my protective wall and what I automatically went into, and then really succumb to the fact that I don't have a father anymore. And it wasn't pretty.
Yeah.
It wasn't pretty.
And it's also because, like, on some level, you didn't lose your dad in 2012. You lost your dad in 2008.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't believe you where you said that. But yeah, I did. Things happen for a reason, but I really actually lost my dad in 2008. and was slowly but surely just lost his physical form in 2012.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I wonder, like, if for him, if, and I, you know, I obviously didn't know your father, and I want to make assumptions, but I wonder if he kind of felt like he also lost, you know, some of himself too. And I think because of so much of the stigma of talking about mental health, and especially if you overlay in the context for Black men, and for people that have been more in a different generation that have been raised with more of those traditional roles, to feel like, gosh, I am the provider, I am, you know, the head of the household, and then to have that stripped away. And then how do you reconcile that? Because it was of no fault of his own. Your father was great at his job. He just happened to be in an industry that, you know, totally cratered during, you know, that horrible recession. And so one of the things that you and I were talking about and that we felt like it was important for this podcast was to say that your grief processing is a work in progress. And you're like, listen, you know, I spent my junior year drug, sex, numbing. And then, you know, senior year, I just like, you know, really pushed into like work and accomplishments. And I was like, I do the same thing, right? I'm really great at work. I'm, you know, I get a ton of reinforcement for the work that I do. I am not as great at some of the interpersonal relationships. And so, of course, like looking at like matching law, like we're going to distribute our time to the things that feel good and we're going to avoid the shit that doesn't. And so you have done like a spectacular job of avoiding your grief for almost a decade.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you were, and you know, it's like, and it's the kind of thing, like I remember talking to Allison Beckelman about this when she, her episode was the PhD with two mental health disorders. She's always been a high performer at work and she was also suicidal. Both of those things coexisted. And I think we really kind of continually to reframe what it means to be doing well. And wellness is not simply like, you know, whatever people think about, you know, the job or title that you have, or even the money that you make, or how you, you know, physically, you know, portray yourself, that it's also that piece of like wellness in your heart and wellness in your mind. And also I think for you getting to this place and, or kind of working towards this place where you can forgive yourself.
And it's the forgiving myself part. You know, I think I've done a good job at forgiving my mother. You know, I felt abandoned by my brother because he was off at Purdue and living a life in Indiana while I was at home dealing with my screaming parents. I also think I have forgiven my father. I had to forgive him, but I have not forgiven myself yet. Yeah. And I'm now 29. He passed when I was 20. So we're going on a decade into this. And I still have not forgiven myself. I always go back to these were the last words that I said to my dad. And I look at how I see my friends that are parents and making those connections. And I'm like, wow, like I hurt him. I contributed to his depression. I contributed to him not being okay. And I did it in a brash, overt, loud, not giving a fuck way. And how do I forgive myself for that when there are so many unanswered questions? You know, my father is gone. I can't ask him how I made him feel. I can't ask him how he felt. I can't ask him about these little things. Did he love me? And all of those things, you know. And, you know, you can go to the therapies and they're like, I'm sure he did. I'm sure he's your father. No, stop saying those things. So I really do need to forgive myself. But part of why I wanted to discuss this is because this is part of me forgiving myself, talking about it, letting people know that you cannot sanitize grief or death, and know that not everything was just peachy keen with the individual relationships. And when people pass and your relationship wasn't peachy keen, it's okay to admit that as well.
Yeah. And I talked to you about this in terms of even like my complexities with Feta. I had told you, you know, 5 days before she died, it was her birthday. There was a whole Zoom party. I didn't go because I was pissed off at her because I thought she was, you know, engaging in things that were harmful to her. I was mad. You know, she was taking a ton of my time. She engaged in tons of attention seeking behavior. It was exhausting. And we had this really good like conversation the day before she passed. And I felt really great after we got off, you know, our FaceTime. And I will say that has been something that has brought me peace with losing her, is that I felt like, okay, I didn't leave anything, you know, kind of unsaid. And that's one of the things that you would talk to me about, is that you're like, hey, listen, what are some of the takeaways I want people to have from listening to this? Make amends with your parents or other important people in your life. Make amends. Because you said anything can be taken away from you at any time.
Yeah. And it's only been reinforced during this pandemic. People went to the grocery store and then got COVID, and then that was it, right? They were sick and they ended up passing alone. Mm-hmm. You saw them on FaceTime.
Yeah.
And know that nothing is unfixable. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's boundaries that you can set, right? People do horrible things, but you set those boundaries. But what I want people to know is that you don't want to have the option to not get your questions answered. Mm-hmm. You don't want to have to forgive yourself for not giving someone grace. Mm-hmm. You know, I am so understanding now to things that my mom still goes through with it. Yeah. You know, she's dating now, and that was a thing. and really, you just don't want that option to never be able to have a conversation. So really, friendships, parents, if you care about that person, if that person birthed you, mm-hmm. Talk to them, make amends, figure out how you can make it work.
Yeah. But I would also say, to use your own words to focus back on you, that nothing is unfixable. That includes you, Adrian. You're fixable.
Yeah.
Like, we're all just human. We all make just mistakes every day. Just doing terrible stuff, whether it's to ourselves or to others. But I mean, like, why live life if you fundamentally believe that we are static and not able to grow or change, right? Like, ugh, what a shitty message. Like, I'm out. You are fixable and worthy of fixing and deserving of that. Do you want to talk about the letter that you got from your friend Megan?
Yes. So I had a friend at the time, her name was Megan. She had lost her mom a couple years prior. Mm-hmm. And she wrote me a letter of the 10 steps that got her through losing her mom. And none of it was, oh, it takes time.
Like, raw. Megan's like, let me tell you,
you know, you're going to be watching a TV show and you're going to bust out in tears. Let that happen. Mm-hmm. You know, and that letter, I was so mad when I lost it, helped me for years. I would reread it and reread it, because it was the real and the raw shit that you go through when you lose a parent or lose someone just so very close to you. And it wasn't clean, you know. Mm-hmm. It was the things, even to this day, you know, he goes to U of M. So the fall time is really, really hard for me always, because the one thing me and my dad did do was bond over football, college football.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Big 10. Hello.
Big 10. Yeah. Go blue.
There's no room for Ohio State in this conversation. It's right. Wolverine all the way. No Spartans.
Wolverines only, and mm-hmm. absolutely no Buccaneers. And that is for you, yeah, Megan Miller. Yeah,
I know.
Whatever. You're don't even really sad. Yeah, whatever. But so every fall, college football comes back around, and it's rough for me, you know. And there'll mm-hmm. be times where I might be watching, you know, a song will come on. He loved DMX. He loved that like hood rap and just like would listen to it. But he was like this hood educated black man. Mm-hmm. So anytime DMX comes on or Shaggy, like all those inappropriate 90s songs.
It wasn't me.
It wasn't me. Yeah. That's what I was listening to. Khalees, Milkshake, all of it. Whenever those things come on. And I think that's the biggest part. And that letter, if I had mm-hmm. not had that letter, I would have been blind going into this journey. Mm-hmm. And yeah, shout out to Megan, mm-hmm. because she helped me more than she knows yeah. now.
Well, and something that I've talked to like Cammie Morgan about in terms of her cancer journey, and also Emily Callahan in terms of her journey with her son's cancer, is like, they both said like, say something, reach out. When people are going through crises, I think a lot of times we're just like, I don't know what to say and I don't want to say the wrong thing, so I say nothing. But if you say something, even if it's, you know, you stumble, or even if you say, I don't know what the right words are, but I want you to know, like, I'm here, I have your back, or here's been my experience, or I found this helpful. Maybe you do or maybe you don't, but I'm sharing it with you anyways. I think having those people reach out and connection, you know, reminds us that we are loved and seen. And like you said, like, gosh, you didn't even realize how beneficial that, you know, just that simple letter and expression of like, here's the stuff that was really hard for me, to help you kind of conceptualize and better understand what you were going through, and then also what you would be going through. And so I would really encourage people, don't be afraid to reach out, and even do it with humility of like, I'm not exactly sure. But let's not say nothing. And also, I think when we reach out, just being able to understand the, you know, discomfort and sadness and death, or, you know, disease. And, you know, when we just give people these platitudes of like, everything's going to be fine, or you're just going to be fine, that actually removes the opportunity for you to speak honestly and to be able to have a chance to process where you are. And it almost like removes your experience. And so I would also encourage people to just like make space, you know, yeah,
that part, say that again, give yourself grace and make space. Mm-hmm. I would definitely say that. And I need to say that to myself. I need to believe it myself and act it on myself. I am still in my journey, guys. This is not we're on the other side. No, we're in it and we're deep in it right now.
Yeah. We're like climbing the mountain. We're like in like, you know, 3,000 feet where you're like, why did I decide to do this? I hate everyone. Yes. And you know, do we get to the top? I don't know. Maybe. Maybe. Or can we just kind of be like, cool, maybe we need to take a break at 3,000 feet. That's okay too.
Yeah. But we're not at the end, that's for sure.
Thanks for listening to Defy. We really appreciate your support, and we hope that you listen to all of the different podcasts that we've put together. And guess what? We're available on all of the podcast platforms and on social media too. And we even have a website. Like, seriously, we have all of that stuff. You can find us at www.defy.community. You can find us on Instagram at defy.comm, on Facebook using the same defy.comm, or you can even send me an email if you just want to chat about something, or if you have an idea of a podcast that you think would be really great for our community. Our email is contact@defy.community. We hope that you have found something that you can take away from this podcast that will impact your life. We hope that you continue to defy society's expectations of you, because remember, baby, well-behaved women rarely make history.